Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Welcome to Borderlines, a Canadian immigration law and policy podcast. I'm Stephen Mirrens. On this episode, we are joined by Sean Rehag, an associate professor at Osgoode Hall Law School. Sean is also the director of the Center for Refugee Studies and the director of the Refugee Law Laboratory. If you're interested in Canadian refugee law, both institutes are definitely worth checking out. Professor Rehag recently published 2 papers which form the basis of our discussion today and today's episode. The first is titled Luck of the Draw 3, Using AI to Examine Decision-Making in Federal Court Stays of Removal. The second paper is titled Claim Types in Canada's Refugee Determination System, an Empirical Snapshot. Both papers are interesting. The second is, in my opinion anyways, a must-read if you want to see a breakdown of refugee success rates based on claim type, judge, country of origin, and more. It actually contains very detailed breakdowns, so beyond just saying that a claim is LGBTQ, it breaks it down based on whether the claimant was lesbian, bi, gay, trans. It gets into very detailed breakdowns of refugee success rates based on, say, forced sterilization, objections to government, and so on and so forth. It's a very interesting paper. I'll link to it in the show notes. And I don't follow many people on Twitter, but Professor Rehag is one. He can be found at SEANREHAAG. Professor Rehag has been on the podcast before in episode 31. Where we discussed his research on extra legal factors that influence outcomes in Canadian refugee adjudication. That was the sentence that I put in the show notes for that episode, but the easy way of thinking about what that episode was how much does a refugee claim depend on who the individual tribunal member is? Today, we discuss Sean's use of GPT to conduct legal research, artificial intelligence and decision-making, differential results in federal court and immigration and refugee board decisions, and how to identify if differential outcomes are significant or actually a problem. It was a very interesting episode and a pretty good follow-up to some of the previous episodes that we did on artificial intelligence. I hope you enjoy today's episode.
Thank you.
think you said in the article, once you have the formula, I don't know if GPT, the formula is the right word, but once you have the code or whatever it's called, that you can easily update it, new data.
Yeah.
Like how long do you think it would take like each year to just run an update?
Like 30 seconds. I mean, it wouldn't take any time to you open up the file and press run and change some of the variables around the year. It takes a little while to run, but you're talking, you know, an hour kind of thing. Like it's not a significant amount of work. The thing that's complicated is actually going out and getting the data. The way that I was getting the data, it's a little bit messy. Like you're going to the federal court's website, you're looking at all of the every single docket, and then you're scraping the information about those dockets, redoing that process. That could be time consuming because you're talking about a couple hundred thousand dockets, and it isn't easy to know which ones would need to be rescraped in order to have an up-to-date database. So the part, as is the case with all data analytics and data science, the challenge is less in the analysis side of things and more in the kind of getting access to the data, which is one of the topics that I engaged with a bit in the in the paper.
Yeah, you mentioned that Canly doesn't let, and I'm probably going to get the terms wrong, but Canly doesn't let you scrape their website. Now, the question that I had was like, you go through the federal court docket. Is that because it's quicker than going through all the federal court decisions themselves?
No. So you had a couple of questions there. One is about Canly. So I didn't use Canly. And the reason I didn't use Canly is because Canly's terms of service prohibit bulk access. So you're not allowed to do what my research does, which is you write a computer program that goes off and tries to grab a bunch of data on legal decision-making. You can't do that. You're allowed to access Canly data one by one if you're like a lawyer and you're wanting to read a case, but you can't access it programmatically. And that's a problem. It's a problem because Canly is the main source that we have that's publicly available that keeps kind of all Canadian case law or most recent Canadian case law in one conveniently accessible format. It's always more or less up to date. And so if you want to do this kind of work, ideally you'd be engaging with Canly, but because of the terms of service, you can't. And that creates asymmetries in terms of access to bulk data, and it creates asymmetries in terms of the ability to play around with new technology on that data. And so you can think, for example, there are large companies that can afford to purchase bulk data, whether they're purchasing it from the commercial branch of Canly, Lexham, or whether they're purchasing it from the big commercial databases. They can do that. There's also startup companies that are accumulating this kind of data. You can think of Blue Jay Legal is an example of a law and tech startup that has put together data. So this data kind of exists. It's in the hands of some commercial actors. It's also in the hands of the government. So the Department of Justice can play around with this data. It's not easily, though, in the hands of independent kind of university-based researchers like me or lawyers who might want to play around with technology in their own workflow. So that's a real problem. But that wasn't the reason why, for this specific STAYS project, why I used federal court docket data. One of the advantages of the federal court's website is that they do allow for non-commercial reproduction, so the terms of service don't prohibit scraping. So that's one reason that I use the federal court's data. But the main reason I use the federal court's data is because not all stay decisions are published. In fact, prior to 2018, very few stay decisions are published. And even since then, there are quite a few stay decisions that aren't really decisions. They're just kind of like orders. Those aren't all published. And so the result is that if you want to go beyond just what's in the published decisions, if you want to study certain kinds of procedural decisions, or you want to study leave decisions, for example, you have to go beyond published decisions. And one of the places where you can look is the online dockets, because they contain information about each kind of step along the way. And so that's why I chose for this project to use the federal court dockets.
Of course, that makes sense, because when we last had you on the podcast to discuss your paper on differential leave rates, that would all be in the docket. There's no published decisions.
And and you clarify this in your paper that the docket, you know, I even looked and I've seen the docket in terms of cases that I've run too. The docket is something much more brief than a decision itself, but that the decisions won't be there on the federal court website. They may be on Canley, but might not be in both languages. And in fact, likely would not be in both languages, but that that at least the basic facts can be scraped off of the docket if you have the savvy to be able to go in and scrape that data and then analyze it. So I thought that was a useful element of that, and to just show what it takes to kind of break down the information that's available on the website for those who have the skills to kind of go in and find it.
Yeah, you definitely don't get the facts of the cases in the dockets. All you really know is that someone has applied for judicial review. You often know what kind of judicial review. Like, is it a judicial review of a refugee decision? Is it a judicial review of an administrative deferral request? And then you know the various steps. Like, did the respondent oppose whatever request, or was there a hearing, or
file a motion record, was it replied to, exactly.
So you have all of that. Whereas on the federal court website, you do also have decisions. Most decisions that are published on Canley are also published on the federal court's website. But one somewhat frustrating exception is stay decisions. So the federal court does identify cases that stay decisions that it thinks have some precedential value. It gives those stay decisions a neutral citation. They're published on Canley and on the federal court website, and they're fully translated. But for cases that are not viewed as precedential, the court does not publish them themselves. They only provide them to Canley, and they're not given a neutral citation. The direct consequence of that, you kind of wonder, well, why are they doing this if there's no precedential value? Like, why are they giving it to Canley instead of publishing it themselves? It's kind of curious, and the answer is translation costs. So because it's not on the federal court website, the theory is that they don't need to be translated. And I'm quite troubled by that logic. Because if it's true, if they're right that they can avoid, if the court is right that it can avoid obligations to translate decisions by just giving them to a third party like Canley, then in principle they could do that for all decisions, right? Like they could simply decide, well, we're no longer going to publish any of our decisions. We're going to give them all to Canley, and if Canley wants to translate them or whatever, they can. But that they don't have to. And so that I think that there's a for those of us who are interested in language rights and in language rights in legal practice, it's a bit troubling.
Yeah, and I would say, and I'd need to look back over my own jurisprudence, if I may, that I have found that when a judgment is delivered from the bench, I have not found those decisions to be reported. And so that I think probably happens more frequently in stay motions where they're going to render their decision from the bench. And perhaps that is another kind of situation in which they rarely do get recorded. Because as you say, they're not considered decisions in quite the same way, but rather just orders. I'm not quite sure what the distinction is here, but that's just something that I have found. I got an order from the bench, but it never turned up as a reported decision.
Yeah, I've done some work in the past about that question, about when does the court decide to publish something versus not publishing something. So I did a project with one of my doctoral students, Pierre-André Thériault, and we looked into the question of. So there was a period where the federal court was deciding whether to publish its decisions using a fairly similar kind of logic that they're currently using with stay decisions. That is, if a decision was viewed as not having precedential weight, then it was not given a neutral citation, and it wasn't given to Canley or anyone. Like, it just never appeared publicly. And so the federal court went through a variety of different practices around that over the last 10 years. When I looked at this empirically, it was kind of interesting to see that some judges viewed all of their decisions as having precedential value, and others as viewed virtually none of their decisions as having precedential value. And gender was a major predictor. Mm-hmm. Gender of the judge was a major predictor of that.
Doesn't
and
so surprise
me. You can. I don't think it was a finding that didn't surprise a lot of people, but it was quite. The difference was quite stark. Mm-hmm. But regardless, there's something that sits with difficulty around the idea of stare decisis, and the idea that a judge issuing a decision is the one who gets to decide whether their decision has precedential value or not. Like, that's not norm. It's not normal.
Yeah, I wonder if that's limited to immigration law or in other areas.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I won a case in 2014 where the judgment just said that the judge was adopting paragraphs, whatever, 35 to 37 of the applicant's memorandum of argument as their reasons. And when the facts came in, I thought, this is going to look weird on Canley, but it was never reported. And then it makes you wonder, like, with judges whose names you don't see that often, whether they are just saying, like you said, that they don't believe their decisions are of precedential value, but they're actually rendering a lot more decisions than you'd otherwise think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots here. There's questions here about the strategic use of being able to decide whether or not your case should be published. You can imagine that if you have a very sympathetic party, but you're a judge who has policy preferences, that prioritize kind of border control, you can imagine, giving a positive decision but not publishing it kind of strategically. There's definitely concerns in the United States around this practice, both in terms of gender and race, and whose voices get amplified in jurisprudence. So there's quite a few concerns. On the flip side, the argument is, well, why do we need thousands of precedents? And especially, what do we do about the fact that we know that jurisprudence on many key issues, that you can find, hundreds of cases that go one way and hundreds of cases that go another way? Like, what are you supposed to do with that as a lawyer, as a judge? And so there has been in many jurisdictions concerns raised about there being too much jurisprudence in the migration context, and a desire to kind of send some signals to the bar about which of those cases are ones that really matter. So you can kind of understand. You can also understand that there have been periods where the court the federal court in particular has had resource issues around translation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, publishing fewer decisions is one of the ways of saving money on that kind of budget line. So there's a lot going into this question of when did decisions get published. My sense, though, is that partly because of the large amount of jurisprudence in the migration field, migration law is one of the areas where moving beyond standard legal research methodologies of kind of reading one case and reading another case and grabbing the bits that you like the best from it, that we need to think about moving beyond that methodology. And I think some of the tools that I use to try to extract meaningful information with the assistance of AI, I think that's one of the directions that that not only academic research but legal practice is probably going in.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at that saying, "Bad facts make bad law," a judge being able to say that they don't want their decision to have precedential value would also, you know, alleviate that concern that those bad facts are going to create bad jurisprudence. Going off what you just touched on in terms of the research that you do with artificial intelligence being helpful for practitioners, you also mentioned in one of your papers that the flip side is that it may be helping the department draft decisions that are just designed to kind of not block, but make judicial review more difficult. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? Because that's something we've kind of talked about, a concern before, is that is artificial intelligence going to lead to better decisions or just better reasoned decisions where there wasn't actually that much consideration given to an application, but the AI is able to produce really solid, almost boilerplate template reasons?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. There is a big difference between AI tools that assist lawyers and automated decision making or automated decision writing. I think they raise different sets of concerns. But on the automated decision making or decision writing side, there's good reason to be concerned about many components of the use of this technology. So one concern is automation bias. So that's really well known in the academic literature that if you give a decision maker a kind of recommendation from a machine, from an algorithm, even if you say, look, this is just a recommendation, and you continue to have discretion to make your own decision, the research suggests that most decision makers are going to defer most of the time to the algorithm. So then the question of who's actually making the decision, is it the algorithm that's making the decision? Is it the coder who put this together? Is it the kind of conglomeration of data that's going into the algorithm? Or is it the actual administrative decision maker? That becomes difficult to kind of figure out. It also becomes very difficult to challenge if you're bringing an application for judicial review, because what exactly are you reviewing? Are you reviewing the algorithm? And if so, how? Particularly given that most of the data is proprietary, it's not open. The algorithms, the process to build them, are typically subject to various kind of contracts and IP limitations, mostly built by commercial folks, like not necessarily in the Canadian context, but in some other contexts where this has been done. So there's just a transparency problem. There is also the question of, so that's a problem in automated decision making. Automated decision writing also has a bunch of problems because it's no longer decision writing. It's decision justification. So it's, you know, here's the outcome and here's a justification that's being offered for it. But what's the connection between the justification and the actual decision-making process, because, you know, depending on how it's done, you can imagine a transparent algorithm and you say, well, here are my inputs and here are the various weights. And like that might mean something, although it's very difficult to do with machine learning because it's so complicated. That might mean something. But if what you're doing is you're taking an input of like a bunch of facts and then you've got an output of a, I don't know, a decision letter, and the decision letter says, you know, I'm not satisfied that you've met this criteria here. The decision letter doesn't actually tell you anything meaningful. And so there's no way to try to get at the actual reason. So this is a real problem. I think we are going to need, for example, to work with experts in artificial intelligence more and more. I think there really is a need to push for some transparency in this area, that if the government does want to rely on data, that it has to disclose that has to be part of the kind of record in litigation. You can't just say, here's the output without giving access to the input. Lots of challenges there around privacy, but I think those are some of the areas that we need to be pushing on. So there's reasons to be concerned. At the same time, though, I think the starting point for a discussion of AI is to recognize that human decision making in the migration field is super problematic, really flawed, biased in all sorts of ways, subjective in all sorts of ways. And the same problem that we have about reasons not being transparent are just as applicable, if not more so, in the human decision making context. So I've done some work with Hillary Evans Cameron on this, where we did an experimental research methodology. We had all the 1L students at Osgoode act as simulated refugee adjudicators. So they looked at a simulated refugee file. It was a sexual orientation file. The only issue at play in the file was credibility, and it was specifically whether the claimant's asserted sexual orientation whether they were being truthful or not with regard to their sexual orientation. So the simulated adjudicators, they had to indicate whether they found the claimant to be credible or not, and then they had to provide reasons for why they found the claimant to be credible or not. And the experimental value that we were playing with was, does what the claimant looks like matter? And so we divided the students into groups, three groups. One group just saw a text, they didn't see an image. One group saw an image of a claimant who presented in ways that tracked onto research about what leads people to perceive someone as straight. Another whose presentation tracked stereotypes about what leads people to view someone as queer. And then we've just looked at the outcomes, and predictably the students were more likely to believe the claimant whose physical presentation matched stereotypes about what sexual minority bodies look like. So that was not surprising. What was quite interesting, though, was that was entirely non-transparent in the reasons. So in the written reasons that were provided, the students who didn't believe the claimant, they looked at, you know, contradictions in the evidence or changes in the evidence or indicators that the claimant had falsified certain documents or whatever. And so if you take the reasons that they wrote seriously, it would appear that it's those kind of traditional markers of credibility that were driving the decisions. But we know, because we have this experimental methodology, that it was actually the image that was driving the outcome. And so I'm quite confident that happens in real life as well. And so just because someone says, you know, here's why your refugee claim failed. Here's why you're not credible. You know, that doesn't mean that that's actually why the person was treated as not credible. So all of that to say that when we, and, you know, my research also shows massive variations in grant rates, depending on who serves as the decision maker at the Immigration and Refugee Board, at the RPD, at the RAD, at the federal court. So all of that to say that human decision-making is a really problematic. And what I would really like us to do, rather than kind of immediately reaching for AI to replace decision-makers, I think we should be using AI to interrogate the decision-makers, to audit decision-makers, to do what I've done and shown that outcomes in federal court stay applications appear to hinge, at least in part, on which judge is assigned to the case. If we do that kind of thing, if we use AI not to catch fraud by applicants, but to identify racism by immigration officers, why would the government think that one of those things is more urgent to do than the other? It's a purely kind of political decision. I think we should be pushing for the use of AI in this kind of rights enhancing way.
Pausing
so your
on
objective
what you said,
then, sorry, your objective in conducting these types of studies is not to push for a move away from human decision making, but for a substantive look at what is driving the variance in the approval rates, and to have there be some adjustment in the way the claims are being adjudicated to create kind of a more uniform rule of law standard. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, we can take that too far. You could have a uniform standard by saying, you know, everyone from Mexico has their claim denied. So you can get to uniformity. I don't think we need uniformity, but a little bit less subjectivity. I think what part of what I try to do in my research is to say, look, there's subjectivity in all of these forms of decision making, and that combines with really high stakes. For some of these, like for stay decisions, someone might be saying, you know, don't send me back because I'm going to be killed or whatever. Like these can be very high stakes decisions. And so by pointing out ways in which there is subjectivity in those decisions, you know, my aim is not to attack the judges or the court or to discredit the system. I have a lot of respect for everyone who engages with the system, including the courts and the judges. My intention is simply to point out reasons to be concerned about outcomes, and then to use that to suggest ways to improve decision making. And so that could mean, you know, greater access to oversight. Why is it that in the immigration setting, it's like one of the only legal settings where there are really tight limits on access even to judicial review, with the leave requirement.
Leave process, yeah.
For example, or what's with letting the federal court judge who decides a case decide whether you can appeal? Like that's a bit a bit absurd.
The certification of the question.
That's right, as a process. So. So part of what I try to do in my research is make those is provide kind of an empirical basis for thinking about that. I also want to, you know, I've had lots of conversations with Immigration and Refugee Board members and with judges about, like, okay, so you've shown us a problem. What can I do about it as a decision maker? And I know that there are judges and Immigration and Refugee Board members who have looked at the data and they've said, "Oh, I really had no idea that I was an outlier on this, and I'm going to be reflective and thoughtful about that." So that's another way that I think this kind of research can be productive and just helpful to get us to rethink our processes.
Yeah, that actually touches on a point that I was going to ask, which is, you know, you're tracking these stats. Did the federal court on their own track these type of stats? Or, as you kind of just alluded to, are the judges kind of seeing it for the first time and everything was so siloed that judges may not have known what the norm was for leave granting or stay granting?
I don't know the answer to, I just don't know the answer. You'd have to ask the court about whether they're doing that. I do know, I have spoken to some individual judges who have told me that they have tried to track some of their own, decisions. I think that's a good question. As an institution, you know, there are really important, strong norms about judicial independence, and we need to, you know, the last thing that we want is to just get rid of judicial independence. So we do need to be careful about this. But most institutions that make high stakes decisions, they think very carefully about how they design decision making to reduce the kinds of errors that are most problematic. And so my doctoral student, Jonathan Kahn, has a helpful way of thinking about this, which is, what might we learn from the airline industry in terms of the design of high stakes decision making in legal settings? So, you know, when a plane takes off, this is a high stakes setting, right? You've got a whole bunch of people whose lives are in the hands of the mechanics and the air traffic controllers and the pilots. And sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes things go horribly wrong. And so what does the industry do? The industry creates a whole series of processes that are designed to try to prevent the worst possible outcomes. They create all these checklists. They have redundancies that are built in. So they have all of these measures, and there's whole kind of scholarly and industrial disciplines that have been built up around trying to create good decision making in these kinds of high stakes settings. And I think the legal system could learn something from that. So why is it that the decision makers get very little feedback on what actually happens? You know, someone isn't recognized as a refugee, is sent back, and you know, the decision maker never knows what happens to them. The Immigration and Refugee Board, you know, there are thousands of decisions that are judicially reviewed. They don't really have a good process for integrating that feedback into their own decision-making processes. It's kind of ad hoc that, you know, a lawyer works for the board will come up with some training based on a particular pattern that jumps out at them. But there isn't like a systematic a way of approaching judicial feedback. I think we should be moving in that direction. And I think what the logic should be: we know this is a high stakes form of decision making. What can we do to avoid the worst possible errors? And I would say the worst possible errors are, you know, sending someone to a place where they're going to be persecuted, tortured, or killed.
Mm-hmm. And as you said in the paper, the standard to which an applicant is held in raising a stay application is that they need to evidence that they would face irreparable harm. And when they're doing that, especially as a last effort, because many of these applications are brought on an emergency basis, there's a huge outlay of resources. And I think part of what you're trying to shed light on through this paper is the imbalance of access to some of the information that that has existed in the past, and just trying to to level that field by use of these AI tools so that at least the applicants have the same degree of access to the information that's available as to the outcome of decisions at the federal court. But I think this idea about what comes from a study like this, I'm just interested in anything that you can offer about the reception that your paper has had in the legal field, at the court, whether, you know, there's been any receptivity to the kind of learnings that it has brought forward, in terms of, you know, what these disparities show, what the court might do with this information, whether it's been approached with a kind of hostility about what you're trying to accomplish by showing the variances. I don't know what you're able to share about, you know, what's happened since it's been published.
Yeah. My experience with the court has been that both individual judges and the court institutionally is interested in thinking about these questions. When I released one of my earlier studies on leave grant rates, I was invited to give a talk to a group of judges at the court, and then the court actually included responding to the research on disparities in leave grant rates in, they included it in one of their strategic plans. And so and my understanding is that the court held a meeting among judges to talk about, you know, when is it appropriate or not to grant leave, with the intent of trying to bring the rates a little bit more into a kind of convergence. So the court has in the past been interested in engaging. For the current study, as I said, I've had engagement with individual judges. I also have a meeting with the Chief Justice to discuss it. So I think there's receptiveness. I do think that there's some understandable and probably legitimate question about, is this an issue just for the federal court, or is it simply a feature of all judicial decision making? And I have been trying recently to look into that question. I've been looking at tax court cases as a kind of comparator to see, is this phenomenon of the luck of the draw present there, using similar kind of methodologies. And so far it seems to suggest that yes, there's a similar problem related to the luck of the draw in that setting, and probably in many others. If you were to do this kind of research on, I don't know, criminal law or landlord tenant, like I'm sure there's a similar phenomenon.
I imagine that the criminal law comparison is a bit more apt, considering the stakes. I mean, not to say that there aren't sometimes high stakes in the tax sector, but it's not the same life, liberty, security of the person kind of interests that that come to play.
For sure. Although criminal law is has some complexity because of the flexibility provided by sentencing, as well as far more extensive negotiations kind of pre-litigation. And so there are some challenges in terms of just researching something like that. But that argument that you made there about the stakes is typically my response to the question.
Exactly.
Well, is this a federal court problem, or is this a problem more generally? On one level, it doesn't really matter. Even if it's a problem more generally, we're talking about high stakes decisions, and in my view, this level of subjectivity is unacceptable in that context, and requires some discussion and some action, even if it's merely reflective of subjectivity in decision making more generally.
Yeah, that's right.
I saw, like, as any And I don't know how out of date this is, but I saw that in 2019, France banned the use of artificial intelligence to try to predict judicial behavior. I assume there's been no grumbling about that here, or is have there been any, like, as far as you know, is there talk of something similar here, or has anyone expressed the same? I think the concern there was forum shopping. I don't, their judicial system's very different from ours, but.
Well, forum shopping, I mean, that kind of concern is I think less of an issue in this context, although not entirely. Some of the research that I've done has.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Identified much lower success rates both at leave and on stays in some French language proceedings. It's entirely unclear whether that's attributable to judges or to, I don't know, maybe legal aid policies in Quebec. Like, there's very hard to know what the cause is, but you can imagine making some kind of calculation related to forum shopping there. But generally speaking, forum shopping is less of a concern here. And I actually don't think that's the real reason why France took the position that they did. I think the concern is around the exposure of the role of individual decision makers in a process that is conceived of as a process that should reflect the law and the facts, not the individual decision maker. And I think that there are some cultural and ideological reasons why it is more concerning to folks in Quebec in France than it is here. I think we're much more used to seeing this kind of research mostly done in the United States, but it's kind of filtered into our culture here. I'm not aware of attempts to try to restrict this kind of research in Canada, but there have been interesting discussions in Australia on this topic. And there are concerns, for example, about ways that that information can be misrepresented, ways that the system of justice could be brought into disrepute by overly simplistic analysis. In general, the response there has not been to kind of outlaw, criminalize research. It's been, you know, to think about how should courts engage with this research, which is something that I think we should do here as well. I mean, I think courts should welcome, should view this as kind of a way of increasing transparency and a potential way to improve their own decision-making practices. And I think they should welcome this kind of research, and I think that we should be facilitating it in other contexts as well. So I don't think we're at risk of kind of going down the French route.
We've talked a bit about IRB or IRCC, and maybe to a lesser extent the IRB using. Well, actually, no, I think we've only talked about IRCC using artificial intelligence to help write decisions. To what extent do you think AI could play a role in helping judges write decisions, or should it be playing a role for judges as well as visa officers?
Yeah, I think it depends what you mean by playing a role. Like there's a big difference. So for example, if you're using Gmail or other similar systems, or you're texting or whatever, there's kind of predictive, what's the next word, and you can just pick the next word. That kind of thing is going to happen quickly, using technology similar to ChatGPT, integrated into word processors. And rather than it just being one word, it's going to be more. It's going to be a sentence. It's going to be a paragraph. And I've watched this. I've been on sabbatical for the last this year, and I spent the year. My kind of main objective for the year was to improve my coding skills, and so I've been coding a lot. And there is an equivalent kind of tool that'll predict the next word. Which predicts the next line of code or the next chunk of code. It's also put together by OpenAI that produced ChatGPT. It's called Codex. It's integrated into some frequently used coding software, and it's really remarkable. Like you're writing away your code. You know, I don't know what the code is. Go to the federal court website and grab these decisions or whatever, and it just knows it puts in like a whole equivalent of a paragraph, and it gets it right. Probably gets it better than I would have been able to do it myself. Sometimes it gets it wrong, so you need to think carefully about it. But it's really impressive that level. We're not very far off from that in word processing software, and I guarantee you that judges and decision makers are going to use this in the same way that we all currently use kind of spell checkers, and we all know how to do Canly searches. Like, so I think that's going to happen. As to whether we have more sophisticated systems that kind of do the equivalent of what lawyers do all the time, where you have an old file that you use as a template for, you know, you've done a stay application, you grab that file, you plug in the new, that kind of thing is also likely to, it's something that you could do fairly easily through AI systems. And I suspect that will eventually happen with decision writing as well. The thing that everyone's more scared of than that, though, is like a fully automated system where instead of actually sitting down and writing a decision, it's more of a checkbox kind of thing. Like, is there a credibility issue? Yes, no. Mm-hmm. Is that? I think that people who have tried to make those, like there's persistent rumors that some IRB member wrote one of these things 15 years ago. I would love to see it. I don't know if that's true. But if you try to do that, you quickly realize that the amount of work involved, it becomes very difficult unless the decision is very, very simple. So for some IRCC decisions, like there's really only five possible reasons why you're denying a student visa, and they're fairly, so, and the letters that are produced are basically meaningless. They're just really citing mm-hmm. a particular legislative provision. So,
and we're already there with those. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's easier to do. It's easier to do where the decision making is less transparent. When you're looking at, why do I believe that you were in fact a survivor of intimate partner violence, like that's going to be very difficult to do as a kind of checkbox exercise. So I would be surprised if we do get there, but there are people who are trying. There are people mm-hmm. who are trying to come up with.
I think the department is trying. I don't know if you followed the whole Chinook and the use of advanced analytics and decision making, but it seems like IRCC is at least trying to move towards this. I've often wondered, if a decision maker has a credibility concern that they have to send a procedural fairness letter, like I wonder if we'll reach the point where a decision maker will be typing, "Oh, I don't view it as credible," and artificial intelligence will just change it to, "I don't believe there's sufficient evidence." And I think that's the direction where it's going to head.
Yeah, I think there's a risk. But I mean, is that fundamentally different than an immigration and refugee board decision maker sending a draft decision to internal counsel for review, who does the exact same thing of being like,
yeah, maybe, I mean, that's,
maybe reword it so that you're not saying, that you're just saying, "I'm not satisfied," instead of saying, "You're not credible," you know, like it. Mm-hmm. So, I think there's reasons to be worried, but I think it's a bigger question than just the technology. I often have this question when we think back, you know, the Baker case, the question about reasonable apprehension of bias by an immigration officer, a decision maker who said, you know, wrote right into the record that the reason that they were denying an immigration application was because the decision maker had basically too many children and was taking advantage mm-hmm. of welfare and just displaying all kinds of racist and xenophobic stereotypes. But there's an interesting question here about, was the decision maker in that case actually doing a good job? Because they were actually articulating their honest reasons mm-hmm. for the decision. And on one level, that's exactly what you want, both mm-hmm. both because it facilitates
that's oversight. Transparency, right?
It's transparency. And would you rather have that same decision maker say, "You have not provided sufficient evidence to satisfy me that you're going to X," right? So I think these are things that we need to be concerned about, but they're, on one level, they're basic administrative law questions rather than necessarily just a matter of technology.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that I've had around AI, and you know, now with you might have an answer to this, and I've discussed it with Deanna before, is it possible, so let's suppose that the AI is going through all past decisions and it notices that visa officers traditionally have had a lower approval rating for temporary residents for people from Africa. Would the AI, is it possible that the AI would make the connection to say, okay, the photos in those applications are primarily from, you know, Black people from Africa, and all of a sudden to start making the leap that Black people based on photographs should be refused based on traditionally people with that skin color in photographs because it was from Africa had a higher refusal rate? Would the AI be able to start going down paths that obviously we wouldn't want? And would you be able to detect that it was starting to make inferences like this?
But it's certainly the case that if you have biased data, which I'm sure we do, like there's no question that credibility assessments are going to be affected by race. There's no question that, you know,
refusal rates from certain regions are higher than refusal rates from others. Yeah,
that's right. Young Muslim men are gonna mm-hmm. That there's going to be certain patterns with those that are different, right? So So yeah, I mean, for sure, that's a concern, but probably also equally a concern for human decision making. Like, the reason the data is biased is because of biased human decision makers. And on one level, it might actually be easier to detect and to stop.
So would that show up like in code, or just you'd notice the pattern and results?
So part of what's complicated about using machine learning is that there's no code. Like, there's code, but there's no instructions in the code about how to make particular inferences. It's what the system is doing is it's inferring, it's detecting patterns and then replicating those patterns. And so, to the extent that the patterns are, you know, racist or problematic in various other ways, the system is going to reflect that. But what you can't do is it's easier to audit AI decision making than it is to audit human decision making, because you can run the thing like thousands of times, and you can change the data that you're feeding in, and so you can do things like, you can try to find ways of masking race in the training data and in the data that you provide to the AI, or you can try to introduce synthetic data. So rather than using only actual data, you can modify the data, so you can create kind of composite data, or you can reduce the amount of data. Like, you could say, well, we're only going to put in into this system a certain number of people from Africa who have been denied their application on this basis, where we're always going to have the same number of people who are granted and who are denied within particular demographics. Like, there's lots of ways that you can play around with it.
Skew the information essentially to remove this sort of systemic bias.
You can either try to mask it, or, and there's lots of kind of new technologies around transparent AI that try to address some of these concerns. So if all that happens is someone goes off and is like, oh, cool, GPT-3 can write me a decision, and I'm going to feed in all of the refugee decisions that are available on, I don't know, on Canly. I scrape all the decisions in violation of Canly's terms of service. I put them into GPT-3, and I then say, okay, here's a new factual scenario. Write me a decision. It's going to write me a negative credibility decision because of the biased data set. So yes, the people who are designing these things need to understand all that. But I also think, as I said before, that there are opportunities here to use AI to do audits on automated decision-making and on human decision-making to make visible some of these biases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as you said from the outset, it's not that these biases don't exist. I mean, right now they're just called local knowledge when you're talking about the visa officer who says, well, I have a suspicion that these documents are fraudulent, or that this marriage is not genuine. They'll refer to this amorphous idea of local knowledge, customary knowledge, or something like that. So, and that's not a data set that you can tinker with when it's a human.
It's also just very difficult to be like, okay, to this decision maker, I'm going to mask the person's race, and I'm going to have you do 1,000 decisions and see whether you come up with the same. Like, there's limitations that are easier to overcome.
What is specifically that local knowledge too? I mean, you can do that in cross-examination, but, you know, in terms of the individual.
You can do it in cross-examination, but then it's, I think that gets back to the study that I did on the impact of the images on outcomes in assessing the credibility of asserted sexual orientation. One of the questions there, and we didn't look into this, but one of the questions there is we know that the image had an impact, but did the decision maker know that the image had an impact? Because it could simply be something that they, like, it's possible that they looked at the person, was like, you don't look queer to me, but I know I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, for sure.
Or it could simply be they had no idea, and like, we're all subject to these kinds of biases that we may not be aware of. And so cross-examination, if the person is being truthful, can get you at that first scenario, but it's not going to help you with the second.
Mm-hmm. Well, your studies always raise very fascinating considerations with respect to rule of law and, you know, fallibility and the decision-making process. I'm always super fascinated with the questions around credibility assessments. I'm just interested if you have other studies that you're kind of looking toward in the months and years to come. What's on the horizon for you in terms of what you're working on now?
Yeah, well, I think Hilary Evans Cameron is the most exciting kind of thinker in Canada at the moment on credibility issues. So if you haven't had her on your podcast, you should, because
we did several years ago on risk saliency and refugee decision making.
Yeah, so she,
and I think she had a website that's My Name Is Gary or
right.
something.
Yeah. I'm
a
refugee meet Gary.
Yeah, Meet Gary.
Meet Gary. Yeah.
I mean, her work is really interesting in this area. We're doing some work together where we're using experimental methodologies again, and looking at markers of non-credible testimony. And so we've given the simulated adjudicators a video of a claimant who's doing all the things that the research says leads people to believe that they're not credible. So gaze aversion and fidgeting and lengthy pauses, emotional kind of affect that doesn't match the thing being said. So all of these things that are often understood to be indicators of lying, basically,
right.
Not coincidentally, are clearly connected with trauma, one of the real problems of credibility assessment. Mm-hmm. So we're showing the students these videos, and then we're also giving them some instructions, guidelines about what they should or should not do in making credibility assessments. And what the research is looking at is, do the guidelines help? Does it help to tell someone, don't rely on gaze aversion, don't rely on fidgeting or whatever, that these are not in fact markers of someone not telling the truth, that they could be markers of trauma? Does that help, or does that do the equivalent of telling the immigration officer in Baker not to refer to stereotypes? In other words, does it just lead to less transparent?
That's like that comment where the jury will disregard the last remark.
Exactly.
The jury goes definitely going to remember that last remark now.
That's what we're looking into is what can we do to improve and to improve decision making?
I had a lengthy discussion at a conference last month or so with the assistant deputy chair of the IRB here in Western Region about efforts that they had made to do trauma-informed training with the members of the RPD here in Western Region. And I have been pleasantly surprised in recent months with the manner in which members of the board have been handling highly traumatized claimants at the board here, and seeing a real uptake in, like, you know, when I've said to board members, this is not something that my client is going to be reasonably able to discuss, that there was really like a shift in what I'm seeing about members being like, okay, no, I totally get that, and not using that as a negative credibility assessment. And this has been particularly with women who have been subject to sexual trauma, and there had been, and so this woman, this assistant deputy chair, was very, very, you know, she was very engaged about like the challenge of trying to overcome this obstacle that you're talking about, not having it become something that you're just not mentioning in your decision, but actually recognizing that those things that were classically tagged to negative credibility findings actually are highly symptomatic of post-traumatic stress. And so just the challenge of that, but I felt like it was really being taken up as a learning and an engagement process that, like, and talking about sort of the neuroscience behind trauma and some of that. And so what she said is that when this learning occurred, when this training happened, that many of the members were like, wow, I really just didn't see this piece. And they were talking about neuroplasticity and how, like, you know, what actually happens to the brain function after trauma. And so this is the sort of thing that I always get. This is one thing that gets me quite excited about the idea of academic learning and how that interplays with adjudication, where adjudicators, decision makers can really start to understand how this new information that's coming into play about how people are impacted in situations of high stress and trauma, that this is, you know, that they're concrete things to look out for. Again, I know it's still fallible, but this is the hope.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to hear that the experience there has been positive. I mean, I've had, I've done a lot of work on sexual orientation based claims, and it's really dramatic when you see the improvement in how the Immigration and Refugee Board has handled those claims from when I started looking at this in, you know, 2005 to now. There are still lots of problems, but they've made real strides in terms of through training, in terms of improving decision making, and I think a lot of that training has been interdisciplinary in nature. So I think there's lots of opportunities to engage with researchers from various disciplines. I also think that law schools do a really terrible job on this, to the disservice of not only people who end up as individuals who appear before administrative decision makers who went to law school, but also to lawyers. I think that we spend so much time teaching about appellate level reasoning and kind of big doctrinal questions, which are important. And as a lawyer, you need to be able to engage with those. But the bulk of what lawyers spend their time doing is thinking about the facts and reasoning with facts and trying to be persuasive about the evidence that they've put together. And it's remarkable that you can go through law school and never actually learn about things like, you know, what does truth telling look like, and,
for sure,
and what's the relationship between that and trauma, or between that and cross-cultural communication. And it's really something that I hope I've been trying to push in my own teaching, to not start with, okay, these are the facts, and now let's talk about the law, but that the process of creating the facts is part of the law, and we need to take it seriously.
The other thing I would add to that is, I think the number one greatest challenge in my practice has been trying to assist a client to communicate their stories to me, and then trying to help them communicate that stories to a tribunal or a court. And the challenges that come with that, like, that has been a lifetime of work, you know, and trying to, like, that's a skill that I've had to develop. And I think that every practitioner who came through law school the same time that I did has had to develop on their own in real time, based on, like, you know, trial and error. How do you, especially when you're dealing with a highly traumatized clientele, how do you get somebody to trust you, to talk to you, to work through those things? And you know, it's very challenging. And then how to help them address those in an adversarial system when they're going to be accused of falsity and lack of credibility and all of that sort of thing. I understand that our system is set up in an adversarial way, but, you know, having to figure out how to help your client navigate that journey has been a super big challenge.
And how to do that without feeling like you're the one that's hurting them. And yeah, no, it's very difficult. It's when I spent several years as the academic director at Parkdale Community Legal Services. And a legal clinic connected with Osgoode. And that was one of the things that we spent the most time learning about together, but also just struggling with, as if you're someone who wants to, who's become a lawyer because you want to work with marginalized populations and you want to help them empower themselves, and you believe in kind of community lawyering principles, and yet part of what you're doing is helping them engage with a process that is traumatizing. How do you do that ethically, morally? Like, it's
honestly, it's the burnout rate is just, it's, I mean, there are not very many people who have managed, like, who continue in this area of practice throughout their entire career. I mean, one of the upsides of it from in the Vancouver area is that many of those not-for-profit or refugee practitioners have now become members of the board. So that's the upshot here, is that we now are appearing in front of people who actually understand this side of the practice. But you know, every year we're seeing some of the people that are entering my year of practice who are just like, they're just done, because it's quite punishing, you know, and to watch your client be put through these types of hearings, facing off against a minister's intervention, it's quite punishing.
It's very difficult. I think it's difficult for everyone who's involved in the system. I think it's difficult for the decision makers. Mm-hmm. I think it's difficult for the judges. I think it's a hard area of practice. Well, I've been thinking about this, of like, how do I teach my students this stuff in a way that's ethical and sensitive to people's lived experiences. There's been a lot of debate in the academy around how do we think about kind of trigger warnings, and mm-hmm. how do we prepare students. And it's one of the things that I've struggled with. I haven't struggled with it in other classes. I teach administrative law, and it's very easy to be like, okay, we're about to read this case that's kind of difficult in the following ways, and here's how we're going to try to manage that. But when I teach refugee law, it's like every single case, it's all about trauma, it's all about violence, it's all about
really is.
And so what does it mean to help people navigate that? I think we often just, you know, it's just the nature of what we're doing, but that doesn't feel like a satisfying mm-hmm.
It really doesn't.
It feels like we're just kind of not giving students the tools that they're going to need if they're going to practice in this area.
I think I have one last question in the interest of time. Of course, Deanna, if you have other mm-hmm. questions. When you see like differential results, how do you like decide or think about whether there's a problem with the data, or not the problem with the data, but like it's a problem that there are the differential results, or you try to dig down as to why? So I'm looking at in your paper, the difference in refugee claims success rate, recognition rate based on sexual orientation type, and it has gay 79%, bisexual 68%, lesbian 84%, transgender 97%, varied other 73%. Like, when you look at those numbers, do you think, okay, like, why would lesbian be higher than gay? Does that suggest that there's, I don't even know what, like a problem with the decision-making, or is there a reason why the underlying facts support that? Like, where do you kind of take your analysis from once you see differential results?
Yeah. And we get the same question around differences in grant rates by judges. Like, if it's a 5% difference, does it matter? Is it 20%? Is it 4%? Like, where is the point at which it matters? Because if you're an individual and you you don't get refugee protection because your judge was 3% less likely to be generous, it doesn't really matter whether it's 3% or 50%. Like, you're still understandably feel that there's been an injustice. And the short answer is there isn't really an answer to this. I think we look at the stakes and we say when we see large differences, it's a problem. And I think we can say that without saying large is 10%, large is 30%. Like, it would be arbitrary anyway. But when I look at the specific example of sexual orientation based claims and the ways that different subsets of sexual minorities succeed at different rates, it becomes even more complicated, because there the issue is okay, I've identified that there's a difference, but what's the cause? Because mm-hmm. one possible read of what's going on with lesbian claimants, for example, is that lesbian claimants are facing persecution not only on the basis of sexual orientation, but also on the basis of gender, and that intersects in ways that are amplifying the harms that they face, and that accounts for it. But there's also a read that would be, straight men find gay men more threatening, mm-hmm. And therefore are more sympathetic to queer women than to queer men. And so I think the answer is that these patterns are interesting, but that we need to know more than just that there's a difference, and we need to look into why. So I have looked into why in the context of bi claimants, an area of interest of mine. So my concern is not that, you know, in this particular study that there's a 60 whatever percent chance if you're bi versus 70 whatever percent chance if you're a gay man. My concern is that pattern has been consistent since 2005, and that if you then look at some of the rationales that have been given in the past, judges were sometimes quite blunt and basically said, bisexuality is not a thing, I don't believe it. Mm-hmm. More
which is a broader kind of social perspective that is not confined.
Invisibility or erasure of bisexuality is a well-known problem. So more recent cases don't do that, but they are more likely to find bi claimants not to be credible. And I think the logic is, well, isn't this a convenient way to explain away a different sex relationship or children? Or and you do see that in some of the cases. And so then that leads you to like, okay, well, if that is what's going on, what can we do? Ranging from actually getting people to think about it for a second, you know, if you were going to make a fraudulent claim and you knew that bi claims are less likely to be successful, and you knew that that you can make a claim as a gay man or a lesbian with evidence of different sex, sexual histories, why would you pick the one that's less successful? So you can have those kinds of conversations. You can have conversations about, well, you know, actually there is a bias against bi folks, and you need to bring that to the attention of the decision makers. And here's some scholarly research about that. So from my perspective, the stats are a starting point. They're a kind of audit, but they do require other methodologies in order to really dig into their causes.
These conversations always leave us a lot to ponder. they're always elicit a lot of interesting thoughts about some of the ambiguities in the system, and many of them are things that we all experience on a day-to-day basis, sort of anecdotally, and we often do amongst ourselves as practitioners, communicate with others who have made appearances before certain judges to kind of get a sense of what we should anticipate. And we all know that we read the decisions of the various judges before we make our appearances. So none of this really comes as a shock to a practicing litigator. At the same time, when we read the results, it does feel pretty stark. And I do hope that these are taken as opportunities for the whole practice area to kind of consider what does this mean for not just fairness in the federal court process, but also just access to justice more generally. And I think that that's always kind of the mandate that you have when you go into some of these academic studies, is looking at access to justice and fairness in the process. And so, I just want to thank you for all of your good work and always raising these super interesting questions and having a very innovative approach to it, because I do think that this is going to open up other studies of its type and continue to help level the playing field between applicants and respondents' counsel, so that that people can continue to use these types of tools to address claims like this.
Would you tell lawyers learn to code?
I think not being afraid to code is worthwhile. I actually think the skill set that leads you to be a good lawyer, which is kind of being able to look at complex norms and break them down into components and try to work through kind of logics and decision trees. That's something that a lot of lawyers are very good at, and that's the same kind of exercise that that one would do with code. But I think that while I would encourage lawyers and especially law students to learn to code, I think what's more important is being willing to engage with the underlying technologies, and as ChatGPT, for example, shows, we're now at the point where you can engage with machine learning without necessarily getting into the kind of nitty gritty of coding. I think lawyers are that, just like, you know, learning how to search Canly is a key skill, learning how to engage with these systems, learning how to interrogate automated decision-making systems. I think these are all things that lawyers, whether they like it or not, whether they learn to code or not, are going to have to deal with.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. Well, thanks. Thanks for coming on. I hope you enjoy the rest of your sabbatical.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for the, thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, anytime.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching.
There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.